It's a download here on WGN Radio. Thanks, Rob. I'm Justin Kaufman. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. My guest now at the big table is no stranger to the WGN Radio airwaves. Walter Jacobson has been a regular on the station for a couple years now. But that's not where Chicagoans know him from. They know him from welcoming him into their living room every night for decades alongside anchor Bill Curtis at Channel 2. Or the anchor alongside Robin Robinson at Channel 32. Walter Jacobson is the 10 o'clock news in Chicago. His ratings at 2 were legendary, and he was able to broadcast in this town from 1973 to 2013. That's 40 years. 40 plus years. Now that's perspective. And this week is the 25th anniversary of one of the biggest stunts in Chicago news history. Walter, homeless on Lower Wacker Drive. Walter Jacobson, welcome to the download.
Thank you, Justin. I'm glad to be here.
So let's go back. Let's start in 1973.
Okay.
When you came to Chicago to do news, what was it like?
Well, wait, let's get a little bit earlier than that, because I've been in Chicago all my life. I've always wanted to be in the news business from the time I was 7 years old, I remember. Even in third grade, I remember wanting to be a news reporter more than anything else, and never wanted, Justin, to do anything
else. That
was it. So I consider myself a very lucky guy, because I've been able to do what I dreamt about doing when I was a child, and no interruptions. But I started on television in 1963. I was about 25, 26 years old. And that was because I was working for a Chicago newspaper, and I got an offer to come to Channel 2, WBBM at the time, because the news director there was a guy who really liked Chicago news. He thought I was kind of a pesty sort of obnoxious guy who would go get the news at any cost, right? John Madigan was his name. And I went to the publisher of the Chicago American at the time, where I was working as a street reporter, and said, could you give me a six-month leave of absence so I could just try television? People in the newspaper business are always envious of people in the television business, because you walk down the street in the television business and people
stop you. High fives.
Yeah. Yeah, right. In the news business, it's like being a football player. You know, you never recognize them because they wear helmets. You
right,
never
recognize
them on the street without the helmets. Anyway, and the money was much better in television.
Of course,
so I asked if I could just give it a try. Like most newspaper reporters, I was down on television. I thought it was
even in 1963, you thought television was just second fiddle kind of thing?
Second fiddle may not be the right words, because it was making more money. It was more successful than the newspapers.
You just thought it was beneath what you guys were doing at the newspapers.
Yeah. And, you know, I just felt that television might be an interesting thing to try, right? So I go to the publisher of the Chicago's American and ask him if I could have a six-month leave. And he used, let's say, bleepable language, which added up to get the hell out of here and don't come back.
Oh,
yeah. If you go to television, that's it. Which was a demonstration of how much people in the publishing business really held television.
And you did it
content.
Anyway, though.
So
but
I did it
you
anyway.
Moved it forward, yeah.
I did it anyway to try. And I found out very fast that television exposure was just a ball. And it allowed me to call people and get the information that I needed to do a story that newspaper reporters probably couldn't, because I was becoming increasingly recognizable.
Let me ask you, because newspaper writing and television writing are they're both journalism, but they're different.
Right.
Newspaper writing, you have a little bit more time and space, and you have to use the word to make, you
That's
know,
right.
to be descriptive. In television, it's very forward. Did you have trouble? Do you have trouble adjusting?
Well, not anymore. I don't.
but at the time, back in.
But I have trouble adjusting now when I try to write for print. In fact, when I left my job after Fox between then and coming back to CBS for just a short period with Curtis, I wrote a book. And I found it very difficult to think in sentences of more than five or six words. And, you know, there's an advantage to both. People's attention span is pretty short. So that's why most people, I would guess, get their news from radio and television, because they can digest it very fast.
Let's move to the point when, okay, so you're doing television, you're doing reporting, you're liking it. At what point did it occur to you that you could be on the anchor desk?
It happened by accident. I went to Channel 2 News in 1963 as a writer and then as a producer of the noon news on Sunday. And the anchor man on the news on Sunday, Carter Davidson was his name, called in sick. Sunday, there are very few people in the newsrooms, as you know. There was nobody there to read the news that I had pretty well written. So I had to do it. It was in the summer. I happened to be in shorts and a T-shirt and sandals. And this was television, right? So I went into the studio, having no idea what you do with the teleprompter. The damn thing goes up and down, you know, and you can't follow it if it's going in the wrong direction. I didn't have a tie, so I ran around all the locker rooms in CBS looking for a tie so I could at least appear to be somewhat serious as a newsman. I'm short. And they put some bricks on the floor that I had to stand on so I wouldn't be, so I'd be over the desk, right? And from my mind, it was an absolute disaster. But it was a lot of fun, and I liked being the big shot.
That's how I started. You got a taste of it. And then they said, well, you know, Walter, let's try some other things. Let's put you here, put you there. Right. At what point did you realize you were getting good at it?
I don't think, Justin, that I ever have been really good as an anchor.
Really?
You know,
you think
Bill
that for
Curtis
real?
Is the, yeah. Bill Curtis is this masterful, stentorian-type character.
But you made your whole life.
Voice.
I mean,
and I was all this kind of, squeaky guy. But I was good at getting what I needed to get a story. And as they thought at the very beginning, I was pesty enough and persistent enough to go get what I needed to get to cover the
What
news.
Do you have to do? I mean... And this is just my curiosity, but what do you have to do to be an anchor? I mean, you just talked about how you felt like Curtis was the guy and you never were really good at it. But you spent 40 years doing it.
Yeah.
What do you have to do as somebody, if you don't feel like you're a good anchor, what do you have to do to fake it?
I imagine most people who become anchors think of themselves as anchors. It's sort of, it goes with the job. If you're a reporter or a writer in television news, you're aiming to be an anchor because the anchor is where all the celebrity and the money and is, right? Mm-hmm. I tried to speak in a way, or was told by my superiors that you better change your voice a little bit, and you have to worry about how you look, so you're careful about that, and you have to just know how to.
So they give you classes
cut
like
off when you have to.
They give you sing song classes where you're like
no sing song classes.
You learn that?
No, not that. But they did give me other things like when I first went to work there as an on air person. As a commentator, they told me to wear glasses because it made me look a little older and more mature. And I was a guy who was popping off on the air about all the politicians. And I was competing with Len O'Connor, who was the commentator at Channel 5. And he had this great Irish look. An Irish town, by the way, that was worked against me, too. Someday when we sit down and have a long talk, I can tell you how this...
I think we're doing that right now.
Oh, well, okay. Well, then I'll tell you this, okay? When I went to Channel 2 back in 1973, after having been there and been fired because I was too controversial... And they said that to me. I mean, we want you to report the news. We're sick and tired of your telling people what to think. Like, I would go to City Hall and stand out in front and say, Mayor Daley said this and this today. Well, I'll tell you what he was really thinking. In a bit of ways, it was obnoxious. But it was accurate, or I wouldn't be here now.
Right.
And it couldn't be, in most cases, contested. And when it was, I responded in a way to establish my honesty and openness about it. And...
What's interesting, though, is that has almost been removed from television news. I mean, it's become niche. You have your Fox and your MSNBC. But the 10 o'clock news local, they almost shy away from anyone giving any sort of opinion.
Oh, I'll tell you. I mean, that's been the difficult part of my life on the one hand. While the other hand, it made me valuable because I was the only one who was doing it. But I drove managers crazy. And I probably still do to some degree here at WGN, though. Nobody said anything to me yet about it, which is just great. But there is no taste for the kind of interpretive and opinionated reporting that there was before. You know, that's what sells. And I don't know why managers at the local level don't understand that. But look at Bill O'Reilly is one of the most popular saleable voices.
Or Rachel Maddow on the other side. Yeah,
that's right. But I think it's too much. I think that there is a lack of fairness and objectivity to a degree that I find it even difficult to watch them anymore. Yeah. I think that Rachel and the MSNBC crowd is just as guilty of over-opinionating a story, which is okay to opinionate because we need some interpretation and opinion.
The over-opinionated is
and you also have to identify it.
Right.
I never was on the air doing a commentary without it saying beneath me in my signature my
commentary.
Name and commentary.
Perspective.
Right. Perspective, yeah.
Walter Jacobson, longtime newsman here in Chicago, my guest tonight at the big table. When we return more, I want to talk about you and Curtis. That's really what we're going to get to when we come back after this break. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. My guest tonight at the big table, Walter Jacobson, 50 years in the business here in television broadcast journalism here in Chicago. Ended on the air, I guess, in television 2013 after a stint at CBS. But I want to go back to Channel 2 as Chicago knew it, the late 70s, 80s. I remember you guys at 82, 83, 84. There was just no other news in the house.
Right. We were at the top of the heap. At that specific time.
Well, let's talk about how you guys came together.
I'll tell you, it's really very interesting. Curtis was a correspondent for CBS News. He was in Los Angeles, and he was aiming at one day his career goal was to be an anchor. And there was talk at CBS that maybe he would, in fact, succeed Walter Cronkite.
At the national level,
yeah. There was. That was his goal.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He wanted to be. And he would have been a very good one. He's just fabulous. I'll tell you sometime what a great guy he is. We had a great marriage for all those years, you know. He was in Los Angeles. I was here on Channel 5 as Len O'Connor's backup in commentary. Channel 2 was at the bottom of the ratings here in Chicago, the worst. So CBS in New York sent two creative, hotshot, fast-thinking men to Chicago to run Channel 2. One of them's name was Sauter. One of them's name was Wessler. One was the general manager. Sauter was the news director under the general manager. I get a call one day from Van Gordon Sauter, who I had known just very briefly when he was a writer in the Chicago Daily News. And I figured he was calling me from New York to say, what is going on in Chicago? I'm coming to Chicago, and maybe you can kind of help
me give me some
get
advice,
situated.
Right. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
He said, I want to meet with you. And in those days, you know, you had to be really careful about who you were meeting
Why?
With. Because if one station sees, if
oh,
your
right,
station
right.
knows you're talking to another station.
That could be trouble.
Yeah, it could be serious trouble. Anyway,
what a luxury, Walter.
Yeah.
It's not a lot of stations these days that are
in those days.
Yeah.
We met in secret at the Four Farthings in Lincoln Park. And we talked for about 2 hours. And he said, I want you to be an anchor. And I'd like to team you up with Bill Curtis. And I said, no, Van, no, that's just crazy. This is a dramatically Irish town. You don't put a Jewish guy with curly hair, maybe 28 or 29 years old, in the anchor desk. It just won't work in this town. Fahey Flynn and John Drury and Len O'Connor, you name them. All the big successful
big stars
anchors
were Irish. Yeah.
Were Irish. Joel Daly, right?
Right.
And anyway, I was at NBC in Chicago, and I was doing my commentary, which I was no longer permitted to do at CBS.
they had already bounced you out of that.
Right.
Yeah, right.
And I was delighted doing it. I mean, who could I rather work under, be mentored by Len O'Connor? I used to sit on the floor at his feet and just listen to him tell the stories about Patty Bowler and the rest of Chicago politicians, okay? Van said, well, we can't have an anchor also be a commentator. We want you because you're an aggressive newsman, and we think that you and Curtis would make, though odd, an interesting couple. No, Van, there's no way after working all this time to get that commentary and going through the dismissal at Channel 2 because I was too controversial and now just give it up to be a newsreader. I don't want to do that. And you'd be making a mistake. And in 2 years, you would see the mistake. The ratings would be bad and you'd be out. So let's not do it. But for God's sakes, Justin, he was really persistent.
Right, you need an agent.
He had a
at
good
this time,
idea.
You need an agent because there's a great opportunity. And all I hear from you is trying to get out of it.
Yeah, I was.
I wish I was.
I didn't think it would work.
Right.
You know.
But it did. I mean, so you made the choice to do it.
Right.
And you know, it's interesting because you're right. At that time, there were no duos like that. You and Curtis. When you came together and you started working, when was it that you said, you know what? there's something here. This is magic. This is 10 o'clock news.
Well, we let the managers worry about what was magic and what would work. But we really enjoyed working together. I had a huge respect for his work prior to his becoming a correspondent in Los Angeles. And he had seen some of my work in Chicago. And we had different interests. He liked to go out. He was always somewhere around the world. In those days, in the early 70s, there was a lot of money in television. So they sent reporters around the world to do stories. That's what Bill wanted to do. I wanted to stay in the office and talk to people on the telephone and dig up dirt on the politicians and try to keep them honest. So he was Mr. Outside, I was Mr. Inside. And that's a good combination. Van Gordon Sauter and his boss, the general manager, Bob Whistler, developed and brought to Chicago the Minicam. The Minicam put Channel 2 on the map. The Minicam allowed the station to broadcast live from wherever anything was happening. These guys also decided to do a broadcast live from a newsroom, not a studio. So the newsroom was the setting, and we were working stories while we were on the air, which is very real, and which was very attractive to people who at that time in the 70s in Chicago were kind of narrowly focused on politics. That was just before Byrne and just after Harold Washington. There was a lot of fighting going on. So politics, which is probably still the biggest game in town next to sports.
Right.
So that's why it worked. But it didn't work at first. For 5 years, it was a struggle. Even though we had the Minicam, the other stations like Channel 7 and Fahey Flynn and those people were so far heads and shoulders over us. But it began to develop into an audience because of the Minicam, because of the reporting from a newsroom, because of the kind of commentary that was drawing attention, if critical in many ways. And at the end of about the third year, these two guys who came in Chicago, into Chicago to build up WBBM again were told it's not going to work. Jacobson and Curtis have to go. And the general manager at that time pleaded for a little more time. And for some reason, they let us stay on for 2 years more. And then at that time,
it took off.
Oh, boy, it really took off. Yeah.
Walter Jacobson is my guest tonight at the big table. We're talking broadcast news history here on the download tonight. Let's take a break for the news. When we come back, I want to talk about the transition out of Channel 2 to Fox. Also want to talk about your commentaries, perspective, and some of the stuff that did work and some of the stuff that didn't. I mean, I have to ask you point blank about, you know, going undercover as a homeless guy.
Right.
That's like you're known for that. And that was an interesting idea that still to this day people kind of get a chuckle out of.
It's a stunt.
So we'll talk about it.
Get direct.
Yeah. Okay. We'll talk about that coming up here on the download. Stay with us. Welcome back to the download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest, Walter Jacobson, the longtime news journalist, anchor here at Channel 2 and Channel 32, and here at WGN Radio now doing commentary. Let's talk about, I mean, you had such a run at Channel 2, and it came to an end. You made a transition to go to Fox, the new kid in town, Fox 32, when it came to town. Talk about that transition.
Okay. I was, as you say, at Channel 2. I was doing my Walter's Perspective and liking it. And the news director at that time wanted me to try to go to hold of John Wayne Gacy, the killer who was on death row in prison. They were about to take the commentary off. Let me continue anchoring, but the commentary was just too irritating for people, they thought. So they said to me, the news director said, we're taking the commentary off. And I said, no, you can't do that. I won't stay here. Yes, you'll stay here. You're under contract, but we're taking it off. Unless, Walter, you get us John Wayne Gacy. If you can get us Gacy, we'll put the commentary on the air permanently, or whatever permanent can be in this business. But so I spent a year trying to get a hold of John Wayne Gacy. John Wayne Gacy was a Cub fan. I was a Cub bat boy when I was 15 years old.
That's right.
So I wrote to him. In prison, the inmates can get mail. They can even return telephone calls, but he would never return the telephone call. But I would get letters back from him about the Cubs and why he'd, and I would say, you know, please, as an old Cub fan, let's get together and let me come and talk to you. And he would say, no, don't bother. Or he wouldn't answer. I called maybe once every other day or a week for a whole year. Finally, for some reason, he wanted to. Maybe he knew his execution was getting too close. He wanted to proclaim his innocence, which he continued to do until his death. And I made an appointment. I had to go through the prison officials because they didn't really like letting inmates, especially those on death row,
especially go. Especially John Wayne Gacy, right?
Yeah, go on, because it stirs up the other prisoners, right? But somehow I got around that. I was probably just overly persistent. Anyway, I went down to the prison, and they put me in a little room with a fluorescent light and a hard table and two hard chairs. They let me set up the cameras, one behind me, one behind where Gacy was going to sit, so they cameras. One would get me for what we call in the business those cutaway questions.
Or you'd have to force tears.
Yeah.
That's your story. They're like, okay, now can we get the cutaway where Walter cries?
Right. They make great use of cutaways.
Yeah, right. So Gacy comes in.
Walk Gacy in chains, legs and arms, hands. I thought he would be a really big guy. He wasn't much bigger than me. I'm, what, 5'7 or 8? Now 5'5 or 4. They sat him down in front of me, and he scowled at me, and he said, okay, what do you want? And I said, listen, I'm so happy to be here, Mr. Gacy. Whatever you want to say, I want to hear. So just talk. And that led him to say, I want to first say that I didn't do any of that. It's all a bunch of bull, he said. And I said, well, but you've been convicted by a jury. The evidence is just incredible. And he said, no, that's just the families complaining about something that they ought not complain about. So I got into a couple of questions about what's going on in the prison and how his life is. And then I sort of snuck in with a question like, how did you do those things? Kill those kids? He looked at me and he scowled again and said, have you got a pencil? I said, yeah, sure, here. And I handed him my pencil. He reached into his pocket. He took out a piece of string. He wrapped it around the pencil and showed me how he strangled these kids.
Man.
He said, this is all you have to do. And he tied it and pulled it. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, he's just admitted it, for God's sakes. So the interview turned out to be really good.
Right,
now,
right.
I'm often asked what stories I like and what stories I didn't. But the only way to answer that is to say it really depends on what I'm thinking about. In terms of liking a story for the benefit of the station, Gacy was probably the best. And in terms of helping me further my career, Gacy was probably the best because it had drew so much attention.
Right.
But I didn't like it.
So covering Gacy in whatever form and for them to put the ultimatum on you to do this story, it didn't sit well with you.
I was telling you that they told me they'd leave the commentary on if I got Gacy.
They still
didn't. I got Gacy and they didn't keep their promise. And that really ticked me off.
Wait, a news channel not keeping their promise,
yeah,
Walter,
right.
Come on.
Now, how could that be? I mean, that's the problem. I couldn't believe that they were not keeping their promise. I was really livid. So I went to look around for something else, and it happened that the woman who was the advertising promotion manager at Channel 2 at that time and developed the promos for the Gacy interview, which ran 5 or 6 minutes a night for a week and a half, she was pulled out of Chicago by Rupert Murdoch himself and given WFLD.
That's and the relationship that got you over
there.
Yeah,
and she liked so much what I did with Gacy, and she brought me over there.
Let me ask you about this because, I mean, the Gacy stuff is, you know, especially in retrospect, you're like, wow, that's amazing to think about how close you were to Chicago history and how great the story was and came out. But that is television news, that sort of stunt quality. We talked about it right before the break. I mean, you did the I'm going to go live on what it's like to be homeless. I'm going to go live on Wacker Drive. There's a point, and it's almost this fine line in broadcast television, especially in news, where the stunt becomes kind of a circus or a joke. You know, and you have been the guy who's really been on that line. There have been stuff like you talk about with John Wayne Gacy where you're like, wow, that's amazing journalism. or the stuff that doesn't go so well, I'm living on Wacker Drive, and everyone just kind of chuckled it off. How do you do that as a journalist, as an anchor, as a newsman? How do you walk that line?
I justified it, and I think legitimately by saying, and I don't have to justify it to the guy on the street or friends. We could joke about it, but when it got in the papers, you know, Rob Feeder, for example, who was
television critic at the time,
yeah, he said, as you've said and others have said, it's a stunt. I don't get confronted with that on the street because who's going to walk up to me and say, "Hey, you just did a stunt"?
Right.
But I justified it in my own mind by telling myself that, you know, Walter, that this homeless problem is a really serious one. And why not show it? Why not tell it?
But you could see why people would think yeah, it's a joke. Because you're not homeless. It's you.
Right.
You're famous. You've got money. You're living up in wherever you're living.
Right.
And you're like, okay, well, let me put on some half gloves and pretend I'm homeless.
Right.
And then I'll put a camera on for an hour and then win a local Emmy or whatever it is. But
right.
But I think that's what the complaint was about.
Right. Yeah, but I made sure that was clear in my reporting. That, I mean, it was obvious, as you say, that I wasn't a homeless person, but who else was there kind of living with the homeless for a time? And, you know, after about 24 of my 48 hours or so, I became really emotional about it. And I really felt for these people. So I did cry. I stood outside in 20 below zero on the north side near Rogers Park at a homeless shelter. And I was just so scared and so empty. You know, it's not so difficult to be in a situation and feel it, that I remember crying and saying, "My God, I don't know what to do now. I'm so cold. What do I do next?" You know, that's pretty good television. And maybe you won't believe it when I say that it wasn't acted. It was real. And maybe that's part of what's made me kind of successful, real about things.
I guess that's interesting, because the notion, or I think what a lot of viewers will view what you did it with skepticism, because they think you're trying to get ratings or trying to get more money or whatever it is you're trying to do. And they don't think that any of that emotion, that empathy is real.
Right.
They think, I mean, that's been a critique of
Absolutely.
Broadcast journalism for years. You helicopter in for 5 minutes and go, "This is terrible. Oh. Let's wrap it up." And you're telling us that was not the case with what you were doing.
God, you know, that is so interesting, Justin, because I have never thought of it in comparison to those fancy anchor people who drop in. And when I watch that, I always say to myself, "What in the world? Come on, you don't know what you're talking about. You're just there for the first 10 minutes, and it's a show." You know what? You're causing me to think
they learned it from watching you, Walter.
Well, maybe you don't. Yeah, that's right. But
no,
I wonder if they think, as I thought, that they were really a part of it. You know, Anderson Cooper became famous because of his work on the hurricane.
Yep, Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah. And I remember, Justin, thinking, "Come on, Anderson, you don't know anything about it." But then as I watched it more carefully, I could see that he really did the work. And then I felt a little bit better about it. I don't think that goes on today. I think that so many bad things are going on with that cable news.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about what's not, you know, as an observer now, you're out of the anchor business. Maybe you could tell us about what you think of the current status of broadcast television news as we know it. Walter Jacobson, my guest tonight here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest, Walter Jacobson. He does commentary here at WGN Radio Now, but of course known for his work at the anchor desk at Channel 32, at the anchor desk at Channel 2, pretty much everywhere. You've worked everywhere in this town. You've done everything.
I am.
Let me ask you, you know, it's interesting because you're not on television now, and you've seen a lot. I mean, we just had just recently the dust up where the producer said the women can't wear hats. I don't know if you saw that, where there's just, it seems cyclical. It seems like broadcast news is just cyclical, like especially at the local level. It's always the same. Is that, when you see it, are you like, "Oh, I remember when a producer said that to us in 1984?
Oh, sure. But I think it's more intense now than it was back then because of the incursion on the viewership by the internet. And the circulation in the newspapers down, and the stations suffering dramatically for money, that they're reaching out in that bad direction increasingly.
And what do you mean by bad directors in the stories they choose, yeah, things like that?
Covering things that are like pet tricks more than what's going on in the budget in Springfield. You know, the obvious remark about that is that's just a shame because people rely on the media to inform us so we can make intelligent choices with our votes.
In our lives, yeah.
Yeah, but they hurry everybody up. You know, Bill and I were called back because they were suffering. This was just 5 years ago. Called us back after we both had been out of the business for maybe a dozen years at least. He didn't want to come back at all. I thought it was kind of a fun idea. The news director called us back because they were suffering so bad in the ratings. They thought that maybe for one day we could give them a boost. So we came in for one day. And they kind of promoted
that. Yeah,
it.
Yeah,
who's
yeah.
coming back? Walter and
right.
Bill back.
Very sweeps week, yeah.
Right. And that day, Justin, the ratings just went over the top.
I watched
that
it.
One. You did?
I did, yeah.
Because you knew from the...
Because I knew, because I'm like, well, that's a nostalgia trip to go
yeah,
back
right.
and
that
watch
was the
that.
Idea. But they were so happy with the numbers, they said, well, geez, maybe we ought to do this on a more regular basis. And Bill and I had fun with it, so we said, okay. They wanted us to do it for 2 years with the understanding that at the end of 2 years, it's over. Because they said they...
Well, let me ask you, when you came back and did it, was it different for you? I mean, was the apparatus different? Was the tone different? Was it harder to do the job coming back, two of you, than when you did back in 1977?
Not when we first started in 73. Yeah. It was very hard then. Then it became easy with experience.
But this time around,
And then this time when we went back there, I had already been anchoring elsewhere and anchoring a Channel 2. There was nothing at stake. I mean, we weren't doing anything. I was writing my book and he was doing his documentaries. And we had nothing to lose by just doing it as long as we wanted to. But they said, you know, you guys are going to die. We need to have our chance to build our own group with youth. So it's the end at 2 years, no more. And at that point, we were beginning to like it. So when they said, well, you know what, it's doing okay, maybe you stay another 6 months or so. Mm. And we did it. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, read the prompter. And
let me ask you this. You know, this is a big issue primarily for women in broadcast news. Where you get to a certain age, and we talked to your counterpart, Robin Robinson, about this. She was on the show not too long ago. But there is this ageism where, you know, you get to a certain point and the news departments say, we need to go younger. And not as much – it used to not be an issue with men because you have the elder statesman kind of thing, the Walter Cronkite kind of thing. But it has changed. You can attest to that, to the idea that you and Bill were working, and they essentially said point blank, we need to get younger. How does it feel, I mean, to be in the business as long as you've been, to have that be a rule?
Well, it's annoying, which is probably my best way to describe it, because to me, it just sounds so stupid. I mean, there is nothing better for a news anchor to be than older and experienced. My God, experience is the thing that matters. But, you know, one of the reasons they do it is that they can find young talent, which the advertising agencies want, young, beautiful talent, men and women.
That's how I got this job.
That's right. Yeah, I could see looking at you. I'm sure. They hire these youngsters from Des Moines and much smaller markets than that because they can get them for $25,000 or $30,000 a year. And they are blonde and blue-eyed and beautiful.
They're on their way up. They'll take the job.
They don't really last very long. Because, you know, especially in this town is so much a news-oriented town. The people who live here really demand information that has some substance to it, especially now. My God, just think of all that's going on with Rahm and Rauner and the police.
Let me give you one more question before we wrap. Chicago, you grew up here. You've been a part of this town. You know it better than anybody because you spent 50 years covering it. What does it mean to you?
Oh, boy. Well, it's my home, and I've never lived anywhere else except when I was in college. And I'm such a Cubs and Bear fan. I should say the White Sox, too. I don't care which team. I just feel a part of it. And, you know, I know it. I do know it. And when I ride the subways, people are still stopping me and talking to me, which is very surprising because I haven't been on television in a couple of years. But that's what they remember. When I say, well, how do you even recognize me? Because it's been several years. And they say, it's the voice. And they say, because when I was 5 years old and 6 years old, I used to sit in the living room with my parents, and they insisted that we watch you. So I just feel a part of it wherever I go, not because of any reaction to me as much as I just like it. I just love it.
Walter Jacobson, my guest tonight at the big table, he does commentary here at WGN, so we'll have him back. Thanks so much for sharing your story and talking to us tonight.
My pleasure, Justin. Thanks for asking.